We're talking about what it takes to build a vibrant community. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And every city, big, small, in between, they all want to be a great place to live and work so that residents can set down roots and feel a deep sense of place. But even when cities have really stellar economic numbers, the low unemployment rate, low crime, the prudent city planning, they still struggle to find their heart, to find what makes this place on our planet vibrant. What are you doing to help your community thrive or grow together? Are you headed to a parade, a picnic, another community gathering? How does this let you get to know your neighbors and come together? And before you head out, let's share your stories. Find deeper connection to where you call home. We're at 800-642-1234. Quint Studer is the founder of Pensacola's Studer Community Institute. That's a nonprofit aimed at improving the quality of life for people in the Pensacola, Florida area. He's also the entrepreneur in residence at the University of West Florida, the author of the book Building a Vibrant Community: How Citizen-Powered Change is Reshaping America. He has a forthcoming book that's called The Busy Leader's Handbook. Quint, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, Kate. It's very nice to be on.
Well, on this 4th of July, you say that we're far more community-minded than we may realize. Where do you see glimpses of that?
Well, I think there's at least, and I'm talking about some of the smaller cities that I get to travel to. Well, mainly I get to travel to cities much like many in Wisconsin, you know, the 50,000, 75,000 and under. And what I'm finding is there's a great desire. Maybe it's nostalgia. I think it's necessity. But there's a great desire to, get involved, be engaged. And again, I don't want to get too far into politics, but I think when people have their biggest issue, they don't think they're going to call Washington or even their state capital. I think more and more people are realizing that the solutions are local. So we're seeing when we bring in a speaker today, we are worried, would anyone come? And now the place fills up, whether it's about walkability or bikeability or opiate crisis. I just think there's a lot more interest. Not too long ago, just had a thing and said, come out and do your chalk art and bring a dish to pass. We had an old-fashioned potluck, and we were amazed at the number of people that just came. And I think they want connections back again. They feel they've lost over the years.
Okay, so chalk art and a potluck. So that was helping bring community together. Quint, it sounds like these are some grassroots, really grassroots feeling coming up in communities.
That's what we're finding. You know, we're in a little town called Palatka, Florida, which is truly the poorest county, poorest city in Florida, 68 counties. And about 2 years ago, they started programming their downtown more. And, you know, they've just been amazed at the amount of people that want to come downtown, want to get to know each other. We see neighborhood associations starting to get back up again. You know, the old days, people, the way cities were built, they were walkable. You weren't way out in the suburbs. You had a front porch. And I think people, even people that had those want those back, but I'm amazed at the amount of young people that want that networking. I mean, that's why you go to restaurants now. They have open tables. You go to workspaces. And it's interesting. People might not talk a lot to each other, but they want to sit by each other. They want to be on there. You know, young people want to have co-work space. So we're seeing a real desire to connect again socially.
We're talking with Quint Studer. He is helping communities with revitalization, and he works on this at his base in Florida. How does citizen power work in your community? How are you celebrating teamwork in the community today for the 4th of July? And why does knowing your neighbors matter to you? Share your experience. Share your neighborhood story at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Quint, for Independence Day, you're proposing celebrating by connecting at the local level, starting with something like a block party. Why does it matter that we get to know and socialize with our neighbors?
I think we've missed that. I think when you go into, whether it be the phone, the iPad, and these are all good technologies that have helped in many ways, but there's always an unintended consequence. And it's sort of amazing. We sort of had a blow up in our little neighborhood where my wife and I live over electric versus gas powered blowers. And James Fallows, the Atlantic, came out with an article that said, you know, these aren't good for the noise and health. And we got sort of into a controversy in our neighborhood over people debating on lawn service. And it was really tight for a while, but it's amazing because we didn't know each other personally. And once you start to know each other personally, then you can deal with these issues much better. So I think that's one of the reasons once we break down things. I've always found if you get to know someone as a human being, then you can deal with the issues much better than just starting out with the issues. So creating ways to, we call them civic conversations. How do we have civic conversations? So, you know, once a month we bring in various speakers, and we've been amazed at how many people show up. And there's people with different interests, but that's sort of like the founders here on July 4th. I mean, one of the great things about the founders, one of the lessons we can learn from them is they set aside self-interest because they really wanted to accomplish something, which was, of course, create a different America. And I think when we get to think about our founders and what they did, we've had people on far end of political spectrums, but when you get local, those things go away. So I think bringing people in the same room, hearing the same information, just works.
Let's take Brenda now in Spring Green with thoughts on her town. Brenda, hi.
Hi. You're like music to my ears. I'm so excited to talk about, to just be able to say thank you for your work. And also, I just want to talk about Spring Green and what an incredible community it is. About 15 years ago, we started an organization called For Pete's Sake in this area to help people who are in need. It's brought the community together in incredible ways. We've raised about $1 million to help people in our River Valley area. Also, that's just because of the community here, because they're incredibly generous and incredibly engaged. And there's so many opportunities. We have a lot of live music events that are free. There's the local night at the Shed every week. During the summers, there's artists. We have a great art fair. We have, I mean, just a car show that's turned into something quite amazing. I mean, over and over and over again, there are just all the, it's such a small town. It's like 1,600-1,700 people, but they're engaged in their community. It's, we have a saying that, you know, small town living is not a spectator sport.
I love it.
and I think it's really true that, that it makes this town special when you ask people to engage, you ask them to show up. They do. They really do. They want to. So I just wanted to say small town living and, Spring Green specifically has just been such a blessing to the state of Wisconsin from my perspective.
Brenda, thanks. Not a spectator sport. Quint, small town living.
Well, I think Brenda should do the rest of the show and I'll just listen in. I think she's absolutely right. Well, I like the fact to be asked. And that's the other thing we've learned. People can sit back and think the same old people, not old, but the same people that have always done it, just wait for them. And I'm amazed when people get asked, particularly younger people who are made sometimes a little reluctant, how they get engaged. What Brenda hit upon something really important is if we want to keep our young talent in our communities, we've got to get them engaged. Because once they get engaged, then all of a sudden that community becomes their community. And I think we have a chance to reverse migration. So many times we've lost young talent to the large, large cities, particularly on the East and West Coast. And that's sort of changing, you know, they've been sort of priced out of those markets. And if we create great communities, because it's all about getting our talent back and keeping our talent. And I think what Brenda said was right. Socialization, programming, and asking them. And I love the fact that it's not a spectator sport.
Quint Studer is founder of Pensacola's Studer Community Institute, talking about what cities can do to become more livable and prosperous. Your thoughts along the way on your incredible town, 800-642-1234. Back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about how to help communities thrive. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. And we know people are moving to cities quite rapidly. The UN projects that by 2050, around 2.5 billion more people will be living in urban areas. And so making cities healthy and livable, resilient, inspiring, all very important, but how did we get there? What do these words translate to on the ground in our own neighborhoods? What do you see working and not working in your city? Are you disappointed in the lack of teamwork in your community? What are you trying to do about it? Join in this discussion any point, 800-642-1234. We're talking with Quint Studer on how to build our communities on this 4th of July and throughout the year. He founded a Florida organization that works to improve the quality of life in the Pensacola area, and he stays with us. Quint, you were talking earlier about the dispute among neighbors over electric versus gas blowers and about how you go about maintaining your lawns. How do you do that with delicate conversations there where you know there is conflict? What advice do you offer for facilitating conversation so that you can really not fight but come to an agreement?
Well, a few things. And, you know, let me tell you, this was not an easy one, surprisingly. But this is probably one of the toughest ones, and you would think there'd be bigger ones. But I think first, education. Excuse me. I think it's so important, and I think that's where the civic conversations comes from, because we have to raise the civic IQ, and that's really what we've tried to do. So when you bring in speakers who can show data, show evidence, whether it's, in this case, the noise from, let's say, a gas-powered blower and how what can that do, when you show the pollution statistics, but then you've also got to help your local, particularly professional landscapers, and also say, wait a minute, I just don't have the dollars to do this. So I think it starts off with getting to know each other. I think it's the second step is looking at the data, looking at the information, because I think we can disagree on some things, but we can all agree that we want our children to have good schools, we want safety, we want a good environment, and so on. And then it came actually down to negotiating when some landscaping can take place, what times, how many blowers will be on at one time, particularly in an urban environment, and then helping some of the professional landscapers financially make the step from, let's say, a gas-powered to an electric power. So it took about a year process, and it started off, you know, unfortunately, more on the emotional side because people just sort of get their feet stuck in. But I think we've made good progress, and it's been sort of interesting to see the sort of the process take place, and it's sort of like not taking things personally. You know, Rusin is from Four Agreements, first ones, don't take things personally. And I think that sort of helped out. But I think raising the civic IQ, and that's been the biggest shock to me, Kate, is how interested people are learning. You know, we bring an outside speaker in like Chuck Marone to talk about infill, taking empty lots and doing something with them. And also we have 5,000 people that watch it on either live stream, and we have, you know, 300 people that show up. And, you know, I love listening. By the way, you know, I went to University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. I spent a lot of years in Wisconsin, so I just love hearing your commercials. I used to camp in Wisconsin Dells, and so it's such a beautiful state.
I don't know. We might just be raising your Wisconsin civic IQ in this moment here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But Janesville's a nice example. You know, Janesville had some real rough hits, and I'm very familiar with Janesville. I have children that live there. Took some very rough hits with Parker Penn moving out, and that hurt so much with their civic IQ, that intellectual capital.
General Motors.
GM shut down, and but, you know, if you look at what they've done, they've gone and through private money, put a town square in on the river. They're putting a river crosswalk in. They went from one-way streets to two-way streets, which were vital. They just raised, again, private money and had somebody paint a beautiful mural on the side of the building. They just had a bike race downtown. And some of it's just building our sort of self-confidence back with our communities.
We're talking with Quint Studer. He's the author of the book, Building a Vibrant Community, How Citizen-Powered Change is Reshaping America. You can join in to talk about your community at 800-642-1234. Have you started or reinvigorated a neighborhood association where you live? What did you learn about the area? Has it led to a more vibrant community, or are you hitting some roadblocks? Join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Quint, your advice is to start a neighborhood association. If you don't have one, you can also join one. What is important about being part of a neighborhood association or having one?
Well, what we've seen with our research into my book, Building a Vibrant Community, when you go into communities, those that have a neighborhood association seem to do better than those that don't. What I mean by that is they're more aware of what grants might be available. Their parks are a little bit better. My wife and I just last week took a walk here in Pensacola to a neighborhood that we don't live in, but sometimes, you know, you drive to walk in another neighborhood. And we went to North Hill, and North Hill Neighborhood Association here is very strong. They have their newsletter. They do their programming. They take care of their parks. And you could just see the difference. And Emily Callen of the University of Chicago talks about, you know, how come some neighborhoods get all the good stuff and other neighborhoods don't? And a big part of it is that neighborhood association. So one of the things we're doing here with the Institute is actually offering courses now on how to build a neighborhood association, you know, how to start it. And then you want to mentor one neighborhood association with another neighborhood association. Because until a community truly gets away from not my neighborhood, but not in any neighborhood, or, you know, every neighborhood is our neighborhood, you really aren't going to have a great community. So I think neighborhood associations are a real core, but they're not easy. And that's why I think if you don't, there isn't one, you've got to sort of help kickstart it by offering how to do it. And then I love that sort of like one neighborhood association adopting another neighborhood to help them set up a neighborhood association.
What about time? You know, building connections, building community, it takes time. And people are at work all day. They're perhaps shuffling kids to activities after work and after school. How do you make time to build these connections with your neighbors and the people around you?
Well, I think you have to do it intentionally. And I think that's the hard part, because you just hope these things would just sort of happen. You know, again, in the days when cities were built until the 1950s or so, they were close-knit together. People had front porches. There weren't a lot of cars, so it just sort of happened. Today, it doesn't sort of happen. So I think you have to do it absolutely by building it intentionally. And I think that's where programming comes in. That's why topic-specific comes in. The other thing we're seeing communities do is offer daycare. So if you're having a community meeting or a city council meeting or a chamber meeting, you literally offer daycare, because that's one of the big challenges many times is you know, the whole, you know, I've got kids, I've got this, I've got that. And I think that's really been vital. And the other thing is reaching out. We had a Scape come in and look at our waterfront. We talked a lot about waterfront resiliency. And one of the things they were doing is putting in sort of another streetscape sort of close to the water, but more walkable. And we went to the art community and said, you know, this is supposed to have artwork along the path. You need to be at these events, because we have a creative class that sometimes wasn't coming to certain events. It's just not in that DNA. But once they saw that part of the planning included art, then you get that whole group. But I think it's being very intentional and not just thinking it's going to happen.
I think the phrase that many communities just don't want to hear is, there's just nothing to do here. How can a community counteract that?
Well, I think you have to ask. So, for example, in one of the cities, Placa, used a few times, because it's such a cool story, because it's a community that just had so much that wasn't working and now has so many things that is working, when a group of people just started grabbing it. And I think it's one of the things that they did is they ran a contest working with their local newspaper, and basically you could win $1,000 just for turning in an idea. And they asked the question, what should be downtown to get you to come downtown? They had over 110 people write down what the downtown should have in order for them to spend more time in it. Then they invited everyone to a meeting to sort of pick. They just picked the winner out of a hat. It wasn't like who's got the best idea. Almost 100 people showed up that day. And not only did that, they broke them into small groups to take some of these ideas and say, what are the next steps? You have to ask. You know, you have to sit here and say, what will it take? What are your ideas? What could work? And I think that's what we're finding. Once you ask, you're sort of amazed at the amount of people that have ideas and good ideas.
We're talking about building dynamic communities where relationships matter, people helping people. Quint Studer is our guide, stays with us as we explore how we can bring this kind of experience into our own neighborhoods. Founded a nonprofit in Florida where he focuses on improving the quality of life in the Pensacola area. Want to share how your neighborhood is doing? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email your thoughts on your community to ideas@wpr.org. Coming up, we'll talk more about downtown revitalization and what communities can do to help these parts of the community thrive. That's after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about vibrant communities, urban planning, and making our cities livable and inspiring. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Cities of all sizes seek this recipe for economic success. But at really the heart of prosperity, we're learning that it's the human connection that matters the most. Are you trying to bring different opinions together in your community? What does that look like? Are you struggling or are you seeing some success? On this 4th of July, what does community mean to you? Be part of the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Quint Studer of the Studer Community Institute stays with us. His organization works to improve quality of life in Pensacola, Florida. Quint, we often hear about downtown revitalization projects and cities really focusing on their downtowns. What are some cities doing to make their downtowns better and improving quality of life there?
Well, thank you. You know, it's interesting because, of course, I end up working a lot here and other places in downtown, and periodically you get that people that don't live downtown saying, well, why is this downtown? And I think if you put downtown as a tactic, not a goal, you can get everyone to see it the same way. I was lucky in about 2004 or 5, Jim Clifton, the chairman of the board of Gallup, at the time I owned a healthcare company, noticed that companies, hospitals we worked with did well, and he wanted to know what we were doing. On a sidebar conversation, he said they had just finished the biggest study ever. Why do some communities thrive and some don't? It's called Soul of the Cities. And he said it wasn't because of location. It was some of them were sort of close to each other, and one would thrive and one wouldn't. So they went in and said, what is it? And one of the things that was interesting is the ones that thrived had what he would call a more vibrant downtown. And what that did is it kept younger people in, because what they did, their research showed that young people particularly want a more vibrant downtown. They want to walk. They want to go to coffee shops. They want to go to bookstores. Ironically, though, we also found the baby boomers also want many of those same things. I'm sure everybody does, but, you know, I go to communities and I say, you know, we ask them, how good is your community at keeping talent home on a 10-point scale? And most of them aren't, you know, they say, we're not doing well with that. So downtown becomes a tactic, and here's real quick what they said you have to. First, it takes a long time. You know, people come to Pensacola. We just got named by U.S. News and World Report the 16th or 15th best community, most desirable community to live in the United States of America. We were sort of shocked ourselves to be ahead of Asheville and North Carolina and so on, and that wouldn't have been that way 15 years ago, but it was 15 years ago, so it takes a while. And here are the four components. You know, number one, you have to program in downtown. People want to say, well, we need more shopping, we need more of this, but people and entrepreneurs aren't going to take a risk because that's what's going to go in there. It's going to be independent, locally owned places aren't going to take a risk of going downtown if there's no people. So you have to start out really programming, as what we talked about, event after event after event. And, of course, in Wisconsin right now, most downtowns will thrive just on a Saturday if they have a farmer's market. You know, so those types of things to program it. Number two, then you have to help small businesses go. We do things, we recommend things if you have empty spots. You work out creative leasings, you run business challenges. But one of the things we find that cities have to do is provide training and development to small businesses. These people are passionate, but sometimes they don't have the skill set to run a company. So we run 20 programs per year for small businesses to come in, from how to hire, how to do cost of goods. In fact, it's really exciting. We have people actually last year from Wisconsin that came down to one of our events in November called Entrecon. So once you get those retail and entertainment going, and you have to plan it. So, for example, in Asheville, they said, we need a bookstore. So they pulled some private people together and said, how can we support a bookstore that gets up and running? Next comes that office space. And it's not just saying we have empty office space. How do you make exciting office space that people want to be in?
Or how do you deal with the vacant properties, the blighted properties that many downtowns are dealing with?
Well, they're being held hostage. And I hate to use that word, but what we have found, every community we go into is sitting on downtowns that have these empty lots, empty buildings that have been let go. So you got to make sure your code enforcement is up and running, because if somebody doesn't have the pain of keeping, if they just don't want to keep their property up, but there's no pain for not doing it, then it just sits there. Now, and this is going to be a little controversial, but we've had to hold our nose a little bit and overpay for some properties just to get the people, the owners, moving along. And people say, well, it's not worth that much. Well, it is worth that much if it's stopping the rest of the development. And that's where government can sometimes come in. But also, we find there's wealth on the sidelines. And in my book, Vibrant Community, I have a chapter on how to get wealth off the sidelines. So, you know, there's usually wealthy people in a community that have money and investment somewhere, you know, whether it's a stock market, mutual funds. And you talk to them about, why not investing and keeping talent here? Again, I know a little more about Janesville, but if you look at Janesville, much of Janesville's downtown, the revitalization has been funded privately, particularly the town square. If you look at Beloit, most of that has been done privately. So you have to get that wealth off the sideline, but you just hit a big issue. We sat here in Pensacola for three decades with two old buildings sitting on the corners. People were so used to them being empty, they just sort of took it for granted. And all of a sudden today there's 16 retail shops in that area, but somebody's got to start it. And probably the hardest part, Kate, but is the most necessary one, but it comes last, is getting people to live downtown. Giving a diversity of housing. A 258 unit apartment building was built 2 years ago down in Pensacola. Everybody wondered, because they had never had anything like that. It had 68 studio apartments, for example. And the average time that an apartment is available right now is less than an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
Once it opens up. Because so many people want to live downtown.
But is that driving up the cost? Are you driving people out because, you know, the market is so tight and you can raise rents that way? You can raise mortgages that way?
You certainly can. Absolutely. And you're always going to run through that issue. So far, we've been pretty pleased with it that it hasn't, because it's more important to have an apartment full than to get a few bucks. But you're going to run into that. You know, when you have a city that gets more popular, you're going to have complaints about raising prices, traffic, and parking. Now, those are unintended consequences. It's better than having nobody downtown, no parking issues, no traffic issue, and no one wanting to live downtown. But it also starts to create circles. What I mean by circles is, for example, neighborhoods adjacent to the downtown then start getting renovated, because, hey, I might not be able to afford there, but, gee, I can be a 5-minute, a 10-minute, a bicycle drive from downtown. So all of a sudden then what you start seeing is a lot more renovation, and you do see it's important to have a diversity of housing. And the way you do it is actually a big part of it, Kate, is through size. And you know, so you have different size units, which is one way to not make sure the prices go through the roof. So out of 258 apartments, 68 of them are studio.
Sure.
There's only 12 three-story apartments. Three-bedroom apartments.
We're talking with Quint Studer. He is the author of the book, Building a Vibrant Community. And you're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. If you could change one thing to make your community more inclusive, more vibrant, more successful, what would it be and why? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Quint, one of your tips is to create downtown one great intersection. What do you mean by that?
Well, you raise your IQ by finding people a lot smarter than you. We brought in urban design, Ray Gindros, who's now retired, and to look at our community, you know, give it a fresh pair of eyes. And they drive around, and all of a sudden he said to us, every city has a great intersection. We did the same thing. Well, what do you mean? And he said, you know, you got to find that intersection that can be your hub, your first circle. So we said, where should it be? And literally, we would have picked a different one. And he said, Main and Palafox, because it slows traffic down there. It's not a wide street. And he said, you want to create that sort of walkability. At the time, it had two empty buildings and two empty lots. Today, it's got full buildings, no empty lots. And in fact, Palafox was named one of the 10 best streets in America. So what he means is pick that intersection and figure out work. Don't spread yourself. You only have so much resource. So pick that intersection, those four corners that work. And if you can get two of the four corners active, you're in good shape. If you get three out of the four, you're in great shape. And if you get four, you've really done it. Now, we have a bank on one of the four, so that's okay. But the other ones we have very active with retail. So we hit three out of four, which I think is pretty good. So that's sort of what he meant. Find that melting pot, that spot that, you know, you can get people going to. So on one corner, we have a coffee shop, a cafe. The other corner, we have clothing stores, Pilates. The other store, you have small little restaurants. And then the circles just start expanding. So that's what we mean by find that one great intersection. Because you only have so much resources, so don't spread them out. Mm. You'd rather go deep than just get your scope so wide that you can't do enough to get a visual impact.
Author Quint Studer stays with us. He works on how to build a vibrant community, and we're learning about what it takes with your insights about your own community and challenges along the way. Join in. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. When it comes to building strong, vibrant, and inclusive communities, what are you seeing in your own? What can other parts of the state and nation learn from where you live? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this in just a minute right here on the Ideas Network. What makes a city vibrant? We're talking about what that means here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Quint Studer has looked at it this way: a place where talent wants to stay, talent that left wants to return, and talent that never lived there wants to be. He wrote Building a Vibrant Community, How Citizen-Powered Change is Reshaping America. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. So if you could change one thing to make your community more vibrant, more successful, what would it be and why? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. And Quint Studer stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Jenny joining us from Williams Bay. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I just have a quick question. I'm wondering if your guest has any suggestions about making a beach more community friendly. What kinds of things he would add to a small town lake beach, if anything?
Yeah, can you describe Williams Bay and the beach that you have?
So you have a tiny beach, but we're like a hidden gem. We're right next to Lake Geneva, and that's where most people go. And so we're kind of a hidden treasure on the lake. It's a really, really healthy, deep lake. It's pretty unique. So we get a lot of visitors, but we have a small town community, and everybody knows everybody, and everybody goes to the beach. But if you could improve the beach for a community, would you add picnic tables, hammocks? Is there anything you could make? Is there anything you could add to improve on the beach at all?
Yeah, let's get some ideas from Quint. What do you say?
Well, first of all, I think I'm very familiar with Williams Bay and the Lake Geneva area, and I think it's absolutely what you said. It's beautiful. I think one of the things we brought in this company, because we have this beach downtown that's sort of hidden, the same thing, and, you know, we just weren't activating it enough. So though it was pretty, we didn't create enough accessibility. Just even the fact that people knew where it was, how to get there. Number two, particularly in today's world with kayaking and paddleboarding, so good. You have to create something particularly for people to store things like kayaks, paddleboards, things like that. I'm 100% with her on create from picnic tables to activity-oriented things. And once again, you do things that bring people down, whether it's they do a thing here in one of our what they call – in Florida, they call them bayous, and spending a lot of time in Wisconsin, too, they look a lot like lakes to me with channels.
That's
they
a good
call
one.
Them bayous.
Yeah.
and you know, they did some really neat, the old rowing, where they have, you know, had the person chant to raise money. But now we actually have a rowing club that started with that. I just think it's what she mentioned. You just can't think, because it's a pretty beach, people are going to go there. You have to activate it, and particularly activating it with people where they can get things to rent. And again, kayaking and paddleboarding are so huge right now. Those types of things that you can bring people down to your community. Because certainly Williams Bay, like many Wisconsin, is so fortunate to have those type of resources available.
Jenny, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Joel now, joining us from Sauk City. Hi, Joel.
Hi. So I've been reading recently that the city of Milwaukee had added something like 20,000 apartment units since Tom Barrett became mayor. And there's been so much development and a lot of corporations building new campuses like Komatsu and American Family and Michaels Corporation. And there is so much development, but I don't know how much of it has really spread to poor neighborhoods and how easy it is to do that and how to like kind of spread the wealth into those areas without gentrifying them.
Joel, really important question there, Quint. How do you not leave people behind?
Well, I think Jeff Speck, and I'd encourage people to go to Jeff Speck, some of his material he's got, because I think that's always going to be a difficult question. And I don't have, if I had an answer, I'd really be something. I think, though, you have to work with the communities and be careful that you create what I call variety of housing stock. And we have found that the old day, everybody doesn't want to have the same looking house, the same type of people, and particularly the younger generation. I think you've got to do that. The other thing we're finding is companies like this, if they're not creating housing with their development, they're really missing it. Because young people particularly want to find a place to live. I know I was talking to a lady yesterday at our ballpark here, and she said, you know, my son's interviewing for a job in Madison, Wisconsin. I said, well, that's a great city. She said, yeah, and you know, he can actually live. They actually provide housing options, because to get talent into Madison, they have to create affordable housing for their employees. And I think you're seeing more of that, but that's always going to be a challenge. And I think that's where the government can come in with overlay districts. And overlay districts, for those people that aren't aware of it, to really start managing what can be built, to what density can be built, how it can be built. Now, I will tell you, developers many times fight overlay districts because they don't want anyone putting any type of restrictions on what they can do. But overall, in the general, I think overlay districts are very, very healthy for a city and for a community. So I'd encourage you to go look up Jeff Speck. He's very active on social media. and he came to our community and answered the gentrification question much, much better than I'm doing right now.
Joel, thanks. Let's bring in Virginia now in Milwaukee. Hi, Virginia.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I wanted to ask the guest about his opinions about public spaces and their importance in making communities vibrant. It's something that I have followed closely and noticed both in, you know, in cities where that's working and cities where it's not so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the question. Again, I'm like a triage person, sending people to better, smarter people than me. I would encourage you to look up James Lima, J-A-M-E-S-L-I-M-A. He's a placemaking economist. And that's, we never know these people existed until we started studying these things. He actually will come into a community and look at placemaking and tell you the return on investment if you do it. So what I mean by that is, if you put some placemaking in a heavily developed area...
And help us understand what placemaking is.
It's basically saying, like, how to use your public spaces better, maybe art, maybe some place to play music. Something that really won't generate direct tax dollars is what I would sort of call it. So you have a community and you're going to put in a little park or... Like us, our placemaking is in Pensacola right now is taking a piece of a waterfront property that's really been underutilized and investing in it. But it's no tax dollars. It's a public piece of property. So it's not going to create direct tax dollars. And some people have a real rough time if it doesn't show exact return on investment. So what he does, he comes in and looks at if you put this park here, if you put this activity here, if you put this band shell here, if you do these types of things, what the economic impact is. So what he'll do is draw a circle around where you're doing it and talk about will you attract more people? Because any city has to be sustainable, and you're sustainable by growing your population, growing your tax base. So I'm a huge believer in what you call space better. But
yeah.
You got to be careful because too much green space is not good. So you got to look at how do we create and put the right thing in the green space in the right location. James Lima is the national expert on this that, again, can have lots of information on it.
Virginia, thanks. And we're almost out of time, Quint, but I'm wondering, it seems like Pensacola has come a long way. Can a community ever rest on its laurels? How do you continue to improve vitality in a community that has been meeting and exceeding its goals?
Well, I think, you know, John Cotter Harvard said, the sure way not to be successful is declare victory. And I think what happens, it's like climbing a mountain. We have a long way to go. I think we've done a nice job on parts of our community, but we've got a whole big section called the West Side that needs to be developed. And we always tried to develop it, but it's sort of cool. It wasn't until the rest of it sort of got full that people said, well, we have to go do that. So you never can declare victory all the time. And I think once you climb a mountain, you see the next mountain you want to climb, there's more opportunity steps up.
Quint, thank you so much for joining us. Quint Studer is founder of Pensacola's Studer Community Institute, and we've been talking about revitalizing communities. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.